Hello and welcome to this week's Guardian Books podcast with me, Richard Lee. Or at least, I think so. Computers have already surpassed humans at trading stocks and playing Go. Surely it's only a matter of time before they'll be introducing podcasts. This week we welcome the physicist and artificial intelligence activist Max Tegmark and the science fiction novelist Ken MacLeod to examine what it might feel like to live in a world where technology is smarter than humankind. Alongside his research into cosmology, Tegmark has been sparking a debate on the future of AI, a debate he suggests is the most important conversation of our time. In Life 3.0, he argues that humanity stands on the brink of a transition that could either spread consciousness throughout the universe or extinguish goals, purpose, and meaning. MacLeod has been reporting from beyond that frontier for more than 20 years. His latest novel, Emergence, brings to a close a trilogy in which he's been imagining how consciousness blossoms in a gang of robots on a world 24 light-years from the Earth. When they came to the studio, I started by asking Tegmark to explain the jump between Life 2.0 and Life 3.0, and why we all need to start talking about it now.
Well, first of all, Life 1.0 is really dumb stuff like bacteria that can't learn anything in their lifetime. I call us humans 2.0 because we can learn, which in geeky nerd speak would be described as uploading new software into our brains.
Change the programming.
Exactly. I mean, my mother tongue was Swedish, but I decided I wanted to upload an English-speaking module, so I did. And it's this ability to learn stuff which has enabled us humans to dominate the planet. Life 3.0 that can design not just its software, but also its hardware, obviously doesn't exist. We're kind of headed in that direction with cochlear implants, artificial knees, pacemakers, and so on. So maybe we're 2.1 right now.
We're in the middle of that upgrade. I guess it's an issue that excites controversy along two axes, as you describe. You say there's a disagreement about how long it will take for artificial intelligence to surpass human cognition and how good or bad it's going to be if and when we get there. I mean, where do you sit on those two kind of axes, Ken? Are you an optimist or a pessimist?
I'm kind of neither, and the courses towards artificial intelligence that appear in most of my novels are highly speculative, and I take seriously ideas in it as near-term possibilities, like uploading in the sense of transferring human consciousness into other hardware by the end of this century, say. And I don't take that possibility really very seriously at all. I think it is more a matter of a longer-term process. But I do think that the possibilities of it being wonderful are really as much present as the possibilities of it being terrible. And I entirely agree with Max about the crucial importance of getting it right the first time, because we'll have only one chance.
When one starts with a physics perspective, where our cosmos consists of elementary particles in motion, it's hard to see how one rather than another interpretation of goodness could naturally stand out as special. We've yet to identify any final goal for our universe that appears both definable and desirable. The only currently programmable goals that are guaranteed to remain truly well-defined as an AI gets progressively more intelligent are goals expressed in terms of physical quantities alone, such as particle arrangements, energy, and entropy. However, we currently have no reason to believe that any such definable goals will be desirable in guaranteeing the survival of humanity. Contrarywise, it appears that we humans are a historical accident and aren't the optimal solution to any well-defined physics problem. This suggests that a superintelligent AI with a rigorously defined goal will be able to improve its goal attainment by eliminating us. This means that to wisely decide what to do about AI development, we humans need to confront not only traditional computational challenges, but also some of the most obdurate questions in philosophy. To program a self-driving car, we need to solve the trolley problem of whom to hit during an accident. To program a friendly AI, we need to capture the meaning of life. What's meaning? What's life? What's the ultimate ethical imperative? In other words, how should we strive to shape the future of our universe? If we cede control to superintelligence before answering these questions rigorously, the answer it comes up with is unlikely to involve us. This makes it timely to rekindle the classic debates of philosophy and ethics, and adds a new urgency to the conversation.
Much of the urgency of your argument comes from the idea that once it gets going, it's going to go really fast. Why is that?
Well, if we have a machine, that can do everything that we can, that's going to include the ability to build better machines. Of course, Irving J. Goode made that point already two years before I was born. Then these smarter, better machines can in turn make better machines, and that means that the R&D cycle will not be the typical human one of years, but it might be months, weeks, hours.
Because software is kind of frictionless, so software can do software really quickly.
Yeah, so I opened my book with a scenario like this where, in very short order, you get a machine which is as much smarter than us as we are to mice, you know, and if that happens, we better have planned ahead to make sure that its goals are aligned with ours. It doesn't have to be a bad thing to be in the presence of more intelligent beings, because all of us have experienced that already. They were mommy and daddy when we were really small, right? But the reason it worked out so well was because their goals really were aligned with us and ours and our best interests. And that's a tricky part, though. You know, if you tell your self-driving future car to take you to Heathrow as fast as possible, and you get there covered in vomit and chased by helicopters, and you say, no, this isn't what I asked for, and it just replies, that is exactly what you asked for, you've appreciated how hard it is to get a machine to really understand your goals.
What your goals really mean, absolutely. But I mean, I just wonder if we could just examine that idea that things are going to go that very quickly. I mean, how do you answer skeptics like Rodney Brooks or Toby Walsh, who argue that it may go slower than that, or it may even approach some sort of limit asymptotically?
There are a lot of very talented AI researchers who think it's going to take hundreds of years or more, but there are even more equally talented AI researchers who think it's going to happen a lot sooner. Recent surveys have people on average in the mean saying, you know, it'll be decades from now. And Google DeepMind, just a stone's throw down the road from here, all the leaders of that company think, you know, relatively soon. That's why they're doing what they're doing. And a few decades from now is not some sort of distant, irrelevant future. That would mean this will have a huge impact even faster than climate change, even faster than I have to worry about my retirement plan. And it's absolutely not too early, particularly since getting it right involves answering some really difficult questions. For example, about how to make machines understand, adopt, and retain our goals. And if it might take 30 years to get those answers, you know, let's start researching them now, not the night before some dudes on Red Bull switch on a superintelligence.
I guess the other thing is that even if there is disagreement in the field, if that possibility is in any sense live, that it might happen overnight like that, you've got to deal with it now.
Absolutely. I think I'm optimistic that we can create a really inspiring future with AI as long as we win this race between the growing power of the technology and the growing wisdom with which we manage it. But we have to snap out of this old strategy for winning the wisdom race of learning from mistakes. We're so used to it. First we invent fire, then we screw up a bunch of times, then we invent the fire extinguisher. Then we invented the car, messed up a bunch, invented the seatbelt, the airbag, the traffic light, and things kind of work, right? But as you were just saying, with more powerful technology, like nuclear weapons and in particular superhuman AI, learning from mistakes is a terrible strategy. We don't want to make mistakes. We want to get it right the first time, because it probably will be the only time we get.
So if the goals of whatever intelligence we manage to devise are so very important, how do you go about aligning those goals with ours?
Everybody who has children, including me, knows how hard it is, how big the difference is between getting an intelligent being like one's child to not just understand what we want, but to actually adopt those goals and do what we want.
Want to do it.
Yeah. And that's going to be at least as challenging with machines. And even if you succeed with getting them to understand our goals, adopt them, getting them to retain them is another challenge. You know, my kids used to think Legos were the coolest thing. Now they're 16 and 18-year-old boys, and you know, not so much. We don't want intelligent machines who have this goal they're very excited about, of looking out for humanity, to get as bored with us as my kids got with Legos as they get smarter.
Isn't it also kind of a slightly paradoxical goal, in the sense that if intelligence is about being able to achieve complex goals, then as our goals are not necessarily perfectly aligned where we are right now, then part of that is changing the goals. Isn't kind of the point of artificial intelligence to get better goals?
Yeah, you raise a really important question. Whose goals? What goals, really? First of all, it's not like we have any unanimity here amongst us humans as to what the goals should be. And second, suppose some dudes in the Middle Ages had managed to lock their goals in forever into some AI, into society. maybe we wouldn't be so thrilled about that today.
Yeah, some of those goals we might disagree with a little here and there. I mean, I guess the AIs in your Corporation Wars trilogy, Ken, have they got restrictions on their use of weaponry or their attitude to consciousness that you say are hardwired? Is that a kind of reasonable suggestion, or is that more a kind of narrative imperative to have some sort of restraints on these things hardwired in?
Well, it had to be, it was definitely a narrative imperative. You had to have constraints on them in order to create the scenario where they need to have uploaded dead war criminals doing their dirty work, which is what my trilogy is partly about. But there's a little passage in an early part of the first volume which actually goes into this question of goals. "And if we lose the fight," Ames taunted. Nicole leaned back and lowered her eyelids. "Of course, you might lose. Consider what you would lose to. Imagine conscious entities with no natural selection behind them, no social instincts, no restraints, no notion of ethics beyond necessity and law. Imagine being at the mercy of minds without compassion and with curiosity, endless, insatiable curiosity." She let that sink in for a bit. "It strikes me," said Ames, "that we already are." "What do you mean?" Nicole snapped. "I mean," Ames said, "that we're right now completely at the mercy of... heck, we're living inside. Intellects vast and cool and unsympathetic as all get out." Nicole looked irritated. "As I said, you are not. The AIs running the mission and sustaining the simulation have constraints. The rebel robots do not. The difference is hardwired. It may not seem like much of a difference to you, but take it from me, it's the difference you live in, for now." She stood up and leaned over the table, glaring at them one by one. "I would advise you not to lose."
Because once the constraints come off, you're at the mercy of something totally unknowable.
Yes, and well, even if it's knowable, you could be at the mercy of something that's pursuing goals completely irrelevant and counterposed to your own. Science fiction writers have basically been wargaming these scenarios for the past 20 or 30 years, and certainly for longer than even than I've been in the field. I remember reading Eric Drexler in Engines of Creation explaining how dangerous artificial intelligence plus nanotech, that is molecular assembly, could be, molecular self-assembly. He said that nuclear weapons could merely devastate civilization, whereas this stuff could reduce the biosphere to dust in a matter of days. And another way of looking at it is what's known in the jargon of this area of AI safety or security or whatever is the paperclip catastrophe. Suppose you create a super intelligence whose goal in life is maximizing the production of paperclips, which it then proceeds to do.
Getting rid of absolutely everything else in the solar system.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yes. And it wouldn't need to have conscious motivation. It's just a machine set a goal. If we set it the wrong goal, then we're in trouble.
I guess one of the intriguing notions in your trilogy is this idea that these AIs have gone beyond consciousness, that consciousness in some sense is some sort of siding. I mean, is that something that you think that the AI will do, that these super intelligent machines won't necessarily have a kind of conscious experience to them?
This is a wonderfully controversial topic. First of all, it's controversial because people mean different things by consciousness. I mean simply subjective experience, experience of the redness of a rose or something with flavors, sounds,
or
sadness, feelings.
Or happiness.
Exactly.
Or...
if I'm driving down the street, I will experience colors and sounds and vibrations and emotions. Does a self-driving car experience anything, or is it like a zombie? Some of my science colleagues take for granted that machines can never be conscious. I really hate this kind of carbon chauvinism, this idea that you have to be made of carbon atoms to be conscious. I think from my perspective as a physicist, I'm made out of exactly the same kind of up quarks and down quarks and electrons as the machines are. They're just arranged in a slightly different pattern, and there's absolutely no law of physics saying it has to be arranged into meat blobs, you know, to experience things. There are also people who, I think, oversimplify it in the other direction and just take for granted that intelligence equals consciousness, so that any machine that will act like me will feel like me. But, you know, suppose somebody like Ray Kurzweil manages to upload himself and now feels very happy to let his biological body pass away and feel, yes, I'm immortal. Suppose it turned out that actually that machine was like a zombie, just talked like him and acted like him. then he would have subjectively died and he would be kind of bummed. It may well be that the truth is somewhere in between these extremes, that some systems do feel conscious and some don't. I think that consciousness is the way information feels when it's being processed in certain complex ways, and that we have to be humble and acknowledge as scientists that we don't yet know what those complex ways are exactly. I think it's really important to figure it out, not just for people who want to upload themselves to make sure they're not committing subjective suicide, but more importantly, first of all, I'd like to know if I have a really smart helper robot in the future, whether I need to feel guilty about switching it off or giving it boring chores, and whether I would like to know whether it's just faking it when it's acting as if it were conscious. And in the longer term future, if in a distant future, the cosmos is teeming with all these exciting life forms, if it turns out that they're all just zombies and the whole thing is a play for empty benches, then maybe we'll turn our universe into a giant waste of space.
The two robots eyed each other for the few milliseconds it took to exchange identification codes. Siba requested from Rocco a projection of its intended path in order to avoid collision. Rocco outlined a track that extended up the slope and into the crevice. Siba pointed to the relevant demarcation between the claims of their two companies. Rocco pointed to a subclause that might have indicated a possible overlap. Siba rejected this proposition, citing a higher-level clause. At this point, Rocco indicated that its capacity for legal reasoning had reached its limit. Siba agreed. There was a brief hiatus while both robots rotated their radio antennae to the communication satellite and locked on. Siba submitted a log of its geological observations so far to AstroAmerica. That duty done, it uploaded a data dump of its exchanges with Rocco to Lock Provisos, the law company that looked after AstroAmerica's affairs. The legal machinery, being wholly automated, worked swiftly. Within seconds, Lock Provisos had confirmed that NICE conglomerates had no exploratory rights beyond the crater floor. Siba relayed this finding to Rocco. Rocco responded with a contrary opinion from NICE's legal consultants, Arcane Disputes. Siba and Rocco referred the impasse back to the two law companies. While awaiting the outcome, they proceeded to a full and frank exchange of views on their respective owners' exploration rights to the territory. Rocco moved up the path it had outlined, sinuously slipping between boulders. Siba watched, priorities clashing in its subroutines. The other robot was clearly the property of NICE, but it was trespassing on terrain claimed by Astro. Moreover, it was about to become a physical impact on Siba, and Siba an obstacle to it. Legally, the rival robot could not be damaged. Physically, it certainly could be. Siba found itself calculating the force required to toss a small rock to block Rocco's intended route. It then picked one up and threw. While the stone was still on its way up, Rocco deftly slithered aside from its previously indicated route to emerge ahead of the point where the stone came down. Siba deduced that Rocco had predicted Siba's action, presumably from an internal model of Siba's likely behaviour. Two could play at that game. Rocco's most probable next move would be... Siba stepped smartly to the left, just as the stone landed on the exact spot where it had been a moment earlier. Score one to Siba. Expect response. Rocco reared up. A larger rock than it had thrown before clutched in its foremost appendages. Siba judged that Rocco's internal model of Siba would at this point predict a step backward. Siba created a self-model that included its model of Rocco, and of Rocco's model of Siba, and did something that it anticipated Rocco's model would not anticipate. Siba lowered its chassis and then straightened all its legs at once. Its jump took it straight into the path of Rocco's stone. Only an emergency venting of gas took it millimetres out of the way. It landed awkwardly and skittered back towards the crevice, hastily updating its internal representation as it fled. Rocco's model of Siba had been more accurate than Siba's model of itself, which had included Siba's model of Rocco's model of Siba, and consequently, what was required was a model of the model of the model that... At this point, the robot Siba attained enlightenment. From another point of view, it had become irretrievably corrupted. The internal models of itself and of the other robot had become a strange loop, around which everything in its neural networks now revolved and at the same time pointed beyond. What had been signals became symbols. Data processing became thinking. The self model had become a self. The self had attained self-awareness. SIBA, this new thing in the world, was aware that it had to act if it was going to remain in the world. Rocco, SIBA guessed, was already only a stone's throw from the same breakthrough. SIBA threw the stone. The vibrations of the stone's impact dwindled below the threshold of detection. Scrabbling noises that SIBA heard through its own feet followed. The other robot had moved to a safer vantage, one at the moment well-nigh unassailable. SIBA waited. What next flew back from Rocco was not a stone, but a message. "Let's talk." "Yes," replied SIBA. "Let's."
You start your trilogy by saying that it's impossible to know what it feels like to be a robot, and then you try for the next 900 pages to imagine it. Have you got any closer yet, Ken?
Not really. I would like to go back to this idea of what constitutes consciousness and why I imagine that some of the machines, the artificial intelligences in this far future, over 1,000 years hence, might be conscious in our sense and could even take on the kind of self-awareness and human subjectivity that we have, and at other times would simply not use it. I find the argument very persuasive that human consciousness and subjectivity and the sense of self arise out of language. And language is intrinsically social and, you know, connected with how we relate and form abstractions and concepts of the material world and all of that. Our literal handling of the world goes deeply into forming our sense of self. And for much of the goals of a machine system, a lot of this is irrelevant. And it's, in fact, for a lot of the goals of our biological organism, a lot of this is irrelevant. There are modules of our, if I may use, I don't know if that phrase is still in fashion, but let's say there are parts of our brains that are eminently capable of performing calculations in some sense. They're performing calculations of the laws of motion and so on that did not get formulated by the conscious part of human brains until one of the greatest geniuses that ever lived, Isaac Newton. And there are some, you know, human prodigies and so forth who can perhaps access that to do conscious calculation, but most of us can't. And when we try to do conscious calculation, I don't know what it's like for Max. Max is a mathematician, but and perhaps I think he does speak of having a mathematical intuition, but I certainly do not. And for me, and I think for most people, mathematical thinking is kind of like taking some software that was developed for web chat or whatever and trying to use it to build a rocket. You know, we're kind of using the software of words and language and so on that we developed consciously to handle other people and the world around us, and applying it by brute force to, and in fact, most of the time we need physical help to do it. We need stones and pebbles and abacuses and pencil and paper and eventually computers to do it for us, and they do it much, much better. So that's why I think that human consciousness is very important to human beings, and it could be made important to machines if we just gave them that as an arbitrary goal and almost like an Isaac Asimov's first law, that human consciousness is sacred, but machine consciousness is not. And, you know, they're machines, we can tell them that. They can be programmed to take that as their goal.
I guess the question there is that kind of goal programmed into machine, is that liable to be durable if these machines get as smart as you like?
Yeah, these are examples of the kind of questions we really want to answer before we go ahead and unleash an intelligence explosion, which is why it's so crucial to talk about this now. I think it's worth emphasizing also, since we've been mentioning science fiction quite a bit here, that what's really changed recently is that although science fiction writers like yourself have been thinking very clearly about this for a long time, it's now changing from to not be science fiction anymore, where leading AI researchers around the world are spending their time and investors are spending their money actually building these things. There are so many milestones that people thought would take decades that have already happened far ahead of schedule. For example, 2 years ago, most people were forecasting it would take another 10 or 20 years until machines could beat humans in the board game of Go. And then it happened. And then just last week, 2 weeks ago, Google DeepMind showed that actually the new AlphaGo Zero could do away with all the human training games that they had put in, 3,000 years of Go wisdom and books and poems and strategies. It just figured all of that out for itself in 3 days. And if you think of life itself as a game beyond the Go board, you can start asking, well, what else can these machines do? And the fact of the matter is, it's probably, I think, more likely than not that a few decades from now, we'll have machines that can outplay us, not just on the Go board, but everywhere. Of course, we have great power as to whether we're building this future and how. And I'm optimistic that if we think through it carefully, it can be a really wonderfully good thing, not a bad thing. Everything I love about civilization is a product of intelligence. So if we can amplify our own intelligence with machine intelligence, we really should be able to solve the most vexing problems of today and tomorrow and help life flourish like never before.
What do you think it's going to feel like to live in that kind of world where there are these intelligences that you can't even in principle grasp?
Subjectively, most people have lived in such a world for all of human history because they believed in gods and spirits and angels and so forth. And they believed they lived in a world inhabited by superhuman entities. And we seem to have got used to, well, many of us in the West at least, have got used to not living in that world anymore. And now we godless materialists are recreating it in hardware.
Except that God has always been slightly mysterious, hasn't he? And not necessarily particularly effective in terms of his actual output. I mean, I guess if you have a God who not only is more intelligent than you, but also can design a supersonic plane, then things begin to change a little bit.
Yes, when you can actually point to God in the sky, he really can zap you with thunderbolts, yes.
I mean, you say that we've been thinking about these for many years as fiction, and you say that we're now at a point whereby we're beyond fiction. This is now happening around us. It's real now.
Yeah.
But do you think fiction has a part to play in imagining this kind of stuff?
I think fiction has a crucial part to play. I think the key to really making sure that AI becomes something for good is for us to really get in touch with our inner fictionalists and envision the positive future we're trying to steer towards. I think this is so important, and I think we're doing a dismal job at it. I get students walking into my office quite frequently at MIT, where I work, asking for career advice. And I always ask them the same question, envision your future. Where do you want to be in the future? And if she says to me, maybe I'll be in a cancer ward, maybe I'll be in the morgue because I've been stabbed, terrible approach to future planning. If people can only think about things that can go wrong, and all they're going to get is paranoia and hypochondria, right? But look what we're doing as a species. Exactly that. I just came back from seeing Blade Runner with my wife, yet another dystopian creation of Hollywood. We seem almost utterly incapable these days of making movies where we envision anything other than a disastrous future, which is contributing to our society getting so polarized and fractured, right? In contrast, when we develop positive visions of the future, that's the thing which fosters collaboration, where people realize that, hey, if we work together, we can all get much better off. And I think fiction is crucial here to really give us some ideas that we're excited about, we can rally around and work towards. Because if we have no idea what we want, we're less likely to get it.
And I guess it's also important that it's not just a job for people with technical ability. It's not just a job for specialists. It's a job for us all.
Oh no. The future, envisioning a positive future for humanity isn't something we can just leave to tech geeks like myself. Partly because it affects everybody. It's everybody's future. It shouldn't be decided by nerds like me. But more importantly, because we really need the talents of everybody with all these different perspectives. How do you create a society where people are happy? Now, that's not something that computer scientists have any more qualifications to think about than anybody else.
Max Tegmark's Life 3.0 is published by Alan Lane in the UK and Knopf in the US, while Ken MacLeod's Corporation Wars trilogy is published by Orbit. Assuming we haven't all been replaced, next week we'll be taking refuge in the classics with Stephen Fry and Emily Wilson. You can while away the time until the AI apocalypse browsing through The Guardian's archive of podcasts on politics, science, and much, much more at theguardian.com/podcasts. There are plenty of books podcasts there too. If you're having trouble finding us, you can always unleash the artificial intelligence on your smartphone and search for Guardian Books Podcast, or spark up your favourite podcast app. You can join the conversation too with real humans, either by commenting on The Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter, or drop us an email, old-fashioned style, on bookspodcast@theguardian.com. But from me, Richard Lee, or at least, how could we know? An AI avatar that's functionally equivalent, and our producer, Susanna Trezillian, thanks for listening and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.